Okay, so yeah, it's mostly about magnetars, right? LFRBs, but the second half will be about fast radio bursts. So the topic I chose for this talk is how energy dissipates around magnetars, basically, and how you drive blast waves from magnetars. So I thought I should start with a brief introduction about what magnetars are. So I don't think everyone here knows that magnetar population has 30 objects, for example. So you see here the positions of magnetars in the galactic plane. So almost all of them are in our galaxy, except for the most famous one, which was discovered first. It's in the LMC. It's the March 76, I think, discovery. The first giant flare that happened in the magnetar. Okay, so, but others live in our galaxy, basically in the galactic disk. You see here the uncertainty in distances. The blue crosses are just regular pulses, ordinary pulses. So they're concentrated, the magnetar population is concentrated in the galactic plane. They're not found in binaries, so they're isolated. Their ages are between 1 and 10 kilo years. And a fraction of them, a significant fraction of them, is found in supernova remnants. It's a reliable way to measure the age of an object. But of course, another way to measure the age is to use the spin down rate. Magnetars are X-ray pulsars, so you can measure the pulsation period, and then you can measure p dot, and then you find p over p dot, which is the characteristic spin down age. So they rotate. They are relatively slow rotators, 2 to 12 seconds period, rotation period. Now the magnetic fields are enormous. That's why they're called magnetars. The fields are between 10 to the 14 and 10 to the 16th Gauss. Okay, so that's it for the introduction. What magnetars are?
How do we know the field?
So, the standard way, there are actually a few ways, but the most standard way you look at, you measure the period of rotation and the time derivative of period.
But that gives you the age, which you don't know.
It gives you the age, but it also gives you the magnetic field, the dipole component of the magnetic field, if you apply the standard spin down formula. So if you imagine if it's a magnetic dipole radiation, if you apply the force free model, it gives almost the same result. So you can figure out what the dipole component of the field is. And there is another way of doing that when you look, but it's less kind of, it's trickier, but you can look for cyclotron lines. And if you interpret them as ion cyclotron line, you can get some handle on the magnetic field. But the standard one is from P and P dot. Yeah.
Their kick velocities are 200 kilometers per second. So why are they so concentrated near the midplane?
So you multiply the two numbers. I think it should be consistent. You multiply the velocity with the age, and I think
oh,
you get,
so they are just something because
yeah,
they're so
they,
young.
Yeah, they're
okay,
young.
Okay.
Yeah. Unlike no, so the kicks, the velocities of the motion are comparable to regular pulse velocities. They're not special in terms of kick speeds after the supernova explosion. But they're young. So, of course, they should be descendants from the magnetar population. They live much longer, but they're not active. So the activity phase is only like kilo years. Yeah. Now, of course, the main reason why they're called magnetars is not only that the field is strong, but it's also because the source of energy is the magnetic field. The rotation provides not enough energy. The spin down power is not enough to power the X-ray luminosity that we see. So another way to estimate the field is just to look for what is available as an energy source. You don't have accretion, you don't have heat in the star. So what do you have? You have magnetic field. So that's how Thompson and Duncan in the first place predicted that and introduced this term magnetars. It's because you need energy. And then when they measured spin down rate in 1998, then they confirmed that the fields, at least the dipole component, is strong enough to, well, see, actually it's still weaker than the field inside the star, probably by a factor of 10.
What was the time scale for the field to degrade?
That's a good question, which I tried to avoid. I don't want to talk much about what's happening inside the star if we want to talk about something closer to plasma physics for this fraction, but it's yeah.
Just time scale, roughly.
The time scales, okay, I have one slide that addresses this overall picture.
Yeah. So this rearrangement across as energy sources ruled out now, or it's still a model?
The crust, what do you mean, elastic energy of the crust?
Yeah.
No, I mean, it's not enough. You need 10 to the 48 erg to, like, the total energy budget, if you take the average X-ray output multiplied by the lifetime of the object, you get something like 10 to the 48 erg. Crust cannot you cannot possibly store this energy in the crust. If you take the shear modulus in the deep crust, which is like 10 to the 30 in CGS units, you multiply by whatever the maximum displacement of the crust could be, which is 0.1 in strain. So this shear modulus times strain square over 2 would be the energy you can store in the crust, energy density multiplied by the volume of the crust, and you get a small number, much smaller than 10 to the 48. Okay, now it's a Newton star. So you see here liquid neutrons. Well, 10% of matter is still electron, proton, plasma. And so that's why it's a very good conductor, even though it's mostly made of neutrons. Of course, fields are frozen. The evolution of the field in the core, also in the crust, is incredibly slow if you just think about ohmic dissipation. It's almost, I mean, the time scales are enormous. Even at the crust, where the conductivity is relatively low, you will be talking about million years. That would be the characteristic resistive time scale in the crust. In the core, it's much longer. So the field cannot evolve because of ohmic dissipation. There are two processes that can transport magnetic field lines and create something interesting, the activity that we observe. There are two of them. So one is ambipolar diffusion in the core, in the liquid core. The other one is Hall drift in the solid crust. Right, so in the solid crust, ions are nailed. Electrons flow because there are electric currents, and electron fluid transports the magnetic field lines. Okay, so the ambipolar diffusion dominates over the first century of life of Newton star, and it's a relatively fast process that can do significant changes in the core. Of course, what ambipolar diffusion wants to do, basically, the field tries to escape the star to the first approximation. And if you wound up due to dynamo in the beginning after the star birth, if you wound up the field, what happens next? Initially, it's frozen, but gradual ambipolar diffusion, it's like very viscous motion, lets the field evolve and partially escape from the star and release its energy through dissipation partially due to ambipolar diffusion itself, which is a dissipative process, and partially it just escapes in the form of pointing flux to the external magnetosphere and then drives activity.
Ambipolar diffusion requires partial ionization. What is partial ionization?
Partial ionization. So here we will be talking about drift. So ambipolar diffusion is the drift of coupled electron-proton plasma, electron-ion plasma, coupled with the magnetic field, with respect to neutral background. So in this case, neutral background is neutrons, right? It's a heavy neutron fluid, and you have motion of the charge component, the frozen magnetic field with respect to neutron fluid. Basically, magnetic field applies stresses, and basically tries to unwind, if you like, through this viscous neutron background. And it takes time, like a century, a few centuries.
Essentially, neutrons are concentrating to the core, and very light magnetic field is escaping, right?
Yeah. It's light in the sense, yeah, I mean, you can think about gravity, yeah, I mean, buoyancy of the field, if you like, but basically, the magnetic field wants to occupy bigger volume.
Yeah.
And get rid of the winding, unwind. Okay, so, but of course, there is also this crust where the Hall drift is happening, and due to the fact that there are electric current flowing in the crust, and also there is interesting dynamics on the Hall time scale, which is longer than ambipolar diffusion time scale. To zero approximation, I think a good picture would be like this. You have something happening quickly due to fast ambipolar diffusion, then it creates initial conditions for something happening for longer time scale for the Hall drift. Problem, and then you can calculate what's happening in the crust and how the field. Anyway, it's a complicated and interesting problem how the field evolves inside the star. I don't want to talk much about that. I will switch to to what happens.
Did you want to consider reconnection in the core?
Yeah, it's a good question, whether you can have reconnection in the core. At some point, so ambipolar, so you're dragging me into this. I'll say a few sentences. So basically, when you have ambipolar diffusion, you can create current sheets inside the star because the field tends to flatten, magnetic fields like to, to develop narrow current sheet. And so if you succeed to bring really opposite magnetic fluxes and it has enough time to narrow down so that resistivity, that tiny resistivity eventually becomes important, then you have kind of reconnection and you can locally release energy. But none of these were studied.
Lamina, right?
Sorry?
Interior lamina. Is lamina, not turbulence.
So some people say, like Miladas in particular, say that this is a kind of turbulent behavior. I don't completely understand why would it work this way. I would say yes, laminar. But I would also say that this problem, surprisingly, ambipolar diffusion, 3D in particular, and 2D, was not studied enough to understand what's happening inside the core.
But I'm just saying that if it's turbulent, there is a very efficient turbulent connection, which will induce much faster evolution.
Well, it's a good problem to think about.
Does being superfluid or superconductor
matter? Aha, that's a good question. So it's another big topic. So a lot of things depend whether it is superfluid or superconductor. So being superconductor is difficult for magnetars because the fields are so strong, they quench superconductivity. Superconductivity is the pairing of protons, okay? But when you are above the critical field, which is density dependent, and it's not very strong in the outer core, it's like 10 to the 15 Gauss. So the fields are stronger than that. So they quench superconductivity, certainly throughout most of the volume of the crust. Superfluidity, which is pairing of neutrons, is probably there. And there are indirect confirmation for that, because when you study the quasi-periodic oscillations that happen after giant flares, you can see that the plasma with magnetic fields, which participate in these global model modes of oscillation, they kind of decoupled from the main mass. And that could only happen if neutrons are superfluid, because superfluidity suppresses coupling between neutron component and charge component on short time scales. This is like hundreds of hertz oscillations.
The moment of inertia is smaller?
The moment of inertia, because of what?
Because of the decoupling.
Effectively, yes. So when plasma oscillates, it doesn't care about the neutron background on these short time scales. Yeah. Okay, the interior is complicated and interesting. And it could be actually a separate topic. I don't know, maybe I made the wrong choice, but I decided to focus. Yeah. Okay. I thought I should focus on more on what happens outside. So, the first approximation, the Hall drift, the ambipolar diffusion, changes the field inside the star, creates magnetic stresses, and these stresses eventually break the crust and make it move. This is still in compressible motion because it's very hard to compress the dense material, so it's more like shear motion. Whatever external magnetosphere is attached to this incompressible conductor, it's going to be twisted because of this shear motion. Now, when the magnetosphere is twisted, it's got the potential, the free energy kind of, the thing that can be released, the energy that can be released. And we do see this release of energy. We see it in several forms. The most spectacular form of this energy release from the magnetosphere is the giant flares. There are three giant flares that we have seen from the entire magnetar population so far. This is one of them. So what happened, and they're all the same. With all the three flares that we've seen, they do the same thing. There is a spike which lasts about 0.5 seconds. The luminosity in the spike, though, is different for the three flares. The maximum we've seen is up to 10 to the 47 ergs per second. Okay, that's the power that comes in the spike. 10 to the 13 times the solar luminosity. It's a pretty enormous event. And then after that, we see the tail modulated by the rotation of the star. Okay, and the standard interpretation, it goes back to Thompson and Duncan work in the 90s, is that, and I think we can be pretty confident that's indeed what's happening. Basically, you dissipate energy, you create thermal plasma that is trapped after this main spike. This thermal plasma, hot plasma, is trapped in the magnetosphere, and therefore it's co-rotating with the star. That's why we see the modulation with rotation period, this modulation. Okay. So it's a huge, basically, and it lasts, by the way, it lasts 6 minutes, and it's how long it takes the fireball to evaporate. It's made of electron-positron plasma. Yeah, basically how long it takes to radiate away the energy stored in this hot fireball. Layer by layer, you evaporate right. Like an onion. Yeah, and when you calculate how long it should take, it's 6 minutes. There's another interesting problem, how it loses energy. There are two mode polarization modes. One of them escapes much easier through the strong magnetic field. The other one has much bigger cross-section, a two-linear polarization, E mode and O mode. And so this E mode carries away the energy from the fireball in 6 minutes. Okay. Now, but the interesting question here, how you dissipate this energy in the first place, right? So suppose you, so you have deformed the magnetic field lines, the external magnetosphere, and then you have somehow you have to dissipate this energy to create this fireball. You have to dissipate it into heat. And so what was proposed right away is that, well, if you have a star quake, if you suddenly displace the field lines, you launch alpha waves into the magnetosphere, and then they develop turbulence. And this turbulence is going to dissipate over time rather quickly. And so the dissipation of this turbulence produces heat that eventually leads to creation of electron-Poisson pairs and this fireball.
So there is no reconnection?
There is. I think it's the second. I'll talk about reconnection. But this kind of turbulence, of course, it's not the turbulence that you would be talking, for example, in Stellamy. Here the field lines are frozen, their foot points are frozen into the star. So you excite alpha waves.
It's just changes the initial part of the cascade. It's a weak turbulence initially, but it goes to strong turbulence nevertheless at some point.
Let me show some similar. I mean, we can discuss it, of course. Yeah. I think it is qualitatively different.
On the range of the weak turbulence. Weak turbulence assumes that we are not moving in perpendicular direction. But it's a limited initial.
Okay, let me show the simulation. We can discuss it a little bit. But I want to keep moving so we don't spend too much time on turbulence, because there is also reconnection, but it's not turbulent reconnection, though. But it's still okay,
let me. Are they created
pairs? Sorry?
Are they created pairs?
Yes. So you create pairs through emitting a high energy photon first. So when you heat once you begin to accelerate particles, as soon as they reach energies like GeV, or even actually less, 100 MeV, then they begin to upscatter whatever background radiation you have, and these photons convert electron-Poisson pairs. They can convert off the field, just because you're there in strong magnetic field, or they can collide. You can have MeV photons. Once you begin to heat this fireball, then its internal temperature is comparable to 1 MeV, and therefore photons just can collide and convert to pairs directly, above threshold for pair creation. So in the end, basically, this energy is thermalized completely inside the fireball. It's just Planck radiation. It's only close to the surface where radiative transport becomes important. Okay, so we played a little bit, we did Xin Yu Li, student at a great student at Caltech, she now postdoc at CETA, did the simulation of turbulence in this context. So one question we try to look at how long it takes to dissipate turbulence. First of all, how it develops from a reasonable initial condition, how long it takes to dissipate it, and how it would compete to another channel, which I'll explain in a few minutes, of removing energy from the magnetosphere. So briefly, just to give you some idea of how the simulation is set up, it's very simple. It's a 3D simulation. So we take Cartesian box, periodic box. We create a localized packet with shear like this wave. So we send one packet, which has axisymmetric, like torsion, localized along the z-axis, along which the alpha wave is propagating. And there is another packet which is symmetric to it. And these two packets collide. Okay? So the periodic boundary condition is equivalent in this case, because it's symmetric setup, it's equivalent to reflection. So the idea is that you have the star which serves like a wall, and instead of having which is actually crucial, if you like, we can discuss it also later, but if you neglect the fact that the field lines are dipolar, but pretend it's played with Cartesian balls, but you do turbulence in 3D, then you end up with this kind of setup. So these alpha wave packets will be bouncing between the walls, and they will develop turbulence because when they move toward each other, they will generate higher K alpha waves, and the turbulence will develop.
So this is Cartesian rather than cylindrical.
Yes. It's 3D, but the setup is axisymmetric. I mean, the initial condition is axisymmetric, but the simulation is Cartesian.
And E doesn't exceed B, or it
can? I'll get to that point, yeah. So the simulation that we've done, we also did some MHD, but okay, the main pseudo simulation is force-free, okay? I will remind you quickly what it is, but basically in this strongly magnetically dominated plasma magnetosphere, alpha waves propagate with the speed of light, and so you have these two packets colliding with the speed of light.
This is compressible MHD or?
This is force-free.
Okay.
That's exactly what, the slide serves to explain this. So basically, we are solving these two Maxwell equations, okay? And you close them with the force-free condition, which is imposing the net force acting on the plasma is zero. From this condition, you can write down what electric current is explicitly in terms of magnetic fields, electric fields, and its the derivatives. And so it's a dynamical system, hyperbolic system. It's well studied by many people. There are two modes in the system. There is alpha wave, which carries current, and there is fast wave, which in this case is as fast as alpha wave because both propagate with the speed of light. So the fast mode is just like electromagnetic wave in vacuum. It doesn't need any current. Electric field is perpendicular to the magnetic field, so it cannot shake the, it's a strongly magnetized environment. It cannot shake the electrons, really. Okay, so two modes. When turbulence cascade develops, alpha waves begin to generate shorter wavelengths, and also it begins to generate due to nonlinear interactions. I talk about strong alpha packets, delta B over B. That's the main parameter of the problem, is the ratio of alpha wave perturbation, delta B, at the maximum relative to the parallel field. Okay, so that's the strength of the packets.
And what is this parameter?
So we did different cases, but it's comparable to unity, let's say, the most interesting case. Because these are talking about strong perturbation of the magnetosphere. That's how you can get giant flare. All right. Okay, I quickly show the development of turbulence. So it turns out it is an anisotropic cascade, which is in K-perp, more than in K-parallel. You see there's much more power in K-perp than in K-parallel. So it's how different colors are different times. It's how you develop the cascade. So you start with almost no modes at high K, and then you build the tail, and eventually you come to the dissipation scale, which is the scale of your grid. So it's not surprising. The interesting, maybe not surprising, point here is that if you do the same thing in 2D, you get completely wrong results. The cascade.
There are no alpha waves.
In 2D. No, you still have alpha waves in 2D, but the problem is that. No, you still have alpha waves. It's a simple, well, wait a second, you have shear. It's a 2D, it's just plain.
You have linear alpha waves.
You have linear alpha waves, yeah. But still you have current carrying mode, in other words.
Well, that's what he said.
Yeah, okay.
He's agreeing with you.
Okay.
He's agreeing with you.
I did not understand.
So the 2D leads to two shallow spectrum, actually diverges in the entire energy budget. So you never reach you never have a steady state cascade, so things depend on your grid, in other words, because you never reach the real dissipation. So 2D is not good for this problem, and 3D you get what you
expect. Too steep for sort of the usual Kolmogorov-Schwede closure, right? I mean, so that should be -5/3, and because you see
pluses
imply you don't have a balance condition.
Yeah, we don't understand exactly.
It's the situation when your K parallel cannot change. This is the situation that we have in the weak turbulence also. And I think that gradually we see steepening. I'm not sure about that, but this is the condition that you cannot change by K parallel.
But we have a comparable to
it. It doesn't matter. He is putting this constraint. He's not allowing moving the boundaries.
So whereabouts is your drive, your original blankness on this plot? Sorry.
It's here.
Oh, it's right. Okay.
Yeah. It's comparable to the box at
0.1.
Yeah, point a few times basically. It's a Gaussian packet with characteristic width, which is like.
So you're kind of forcing your system to have a forward cascade. So you're generating your leap modes directly in the wave interactions. Okay.
Yeah. So because it's a strong perturbation, you have nonlinear action quickly. You can also look at selection rules. So alpha waves, actually, they cannot directly participate in three-wave interaction producing another alpha wave. So if you do linear analysis, so you can get a fast mode, you can have four-wave interaction, two alpha waves go from two alpha waves.
Because I was thinking of the parametric decay instability, but you don't have that because you don't have a sound. So
no,
that's
right.
The thing what you were saying.
So I'm confused about the evolution. So this sounds like you're doing a decaying situation, right? You have the initial wave set up and you let it go.
Yeah, you need to generate turbulence though.
Yes, but yeah. Then your last time frame, which I can't tell, it's one of the deeper, the purple color.
Yeah, it goes there and then a little bit back.
It's what's causing it to go up and back down?
Yeah, so it looks like there is some energy backflow before it goes to quasi-steady state. And of course, it's also decaying on a similar time scale. So I don't know. So what happens here, you start with two alpha wave packets. You first wait to develop the turbulence. So the way you develop it, you populate certain modes due to resonant interactions, and then you develop more and more modes in the decay space. That's why it takes relatively long time. It takes like tens or up to 100 collisions to fully develop turbulence. But once your spectrum reaches the dissipation scale, you start to remove energy from the system.
By
dissipation. So it's a cascade. It's the standard energy flow from large scales to small scales.
Resistivity or by
so the way no it's just grid heating and
oh,
so of course you have
okay.
Yeah, numerical, you have to check it, so you do different resolutions and then you have to check that you converge, so the grid heating doesn't really affect the cascade. So that's what we've done.
Are there periodic boundary conditions? Do they keep crossing each other or are they just
periodic? Yeah.
And what's the transfer, like in the transfer there is some wave packet size or no?
Yes.
What is it? Is it the same as
it's comparable. So in 3D, yes. So periodic boundary conditions, which are equivalent to reflection.
So they just keep crossing each other.
They keep crossing. So the setup is meant to simulate alpha waves bouncing on closed field lines attached to star. So they go there and back bouncing.
And what is the boundary condition in the other direction?
So here we played with two conditions. So one is also periodic, and this way you keep all the energy in the box, right? But the other one is the escape boundary, rather like effectively absorption, but it allows waves to escape. So alpha waves are always ducted along the magnetic field lines. So they are trapped in the middle of the box where we initiated the perturbation. But the other mode, the fast mode, can obliquely go and get out from this alpha wave populated magnetic field line bundle. And so if you allow absorption at the boundary, rather escape at the boundaries, you begin to drain your energy from the system. And so one question that we studied here, which is also of course interesting, it affects the lifetime of turbulence in the magnetosphere, is what fraction of the energy you deposit in the first place, what fraction of this energy will be carried away by the fast modes from the system? And the short answer is that it's small.
In the setup initial, you are sending alphanic perturbations, or you are sending both fast and alpha perturbations?
The initial setup is pure alpha wave.
Okay.
Yeah, just you basically start with E and B field such that E cross B gives you pointing flux that is the speed of the wave. You start with two packets that move toward each other.
I think balancing is, in this case, is the distribution of the energy. And I would really like you to draw another line corresponding to spectrum k perpendicular minus 5/3, because I think that it would be helpful to see whether, apart from the initial part, where
I agree,
this influenced by boundaries, we get
small differences. Yeah, would be nice to know. Would be to guide your idea. Would be nice to have it. I mean, you see, it's quite noisy for a good reason also because you.
And the green is actually a little shallower. It's
yeah.
Frankly, I'm very surprised for the bombs at 10, 20, 30. Because we almost never see such bumps in similar studies.
Oh. I think if something's decaying, you should expect that because you reach the grid and then it decays, and the turbulence decays, you hold.
What's your grid?
In this, it's 763 cube.
This is. The relativistic turbulence, and there is more coupling between fast modes and alpha modes compared to non-relativistic case. So we may have initially some dominance of alpha modes, but then some energy can go in more equipartition between the modes, and then it can explain the change.
I think even with reduced MHD, the melon modes would still see something like that, because you get a cascade going down to your grid, and then the whole turbulence starts decaying, and the way it does that is it moves to a larger scale.
Did you try like elongated arcs versus pure cube without
It's not really important because still your turbulence is alpha wave turbulence is confined in the middle of the box more or less. The group speed is always along B. So I'm not sure what, I mean, because you need to have box in the perpendicular direction which is big enough to accommodate your packet safely, let's say, by a factor of few, and I think that you're good then. Because whatever electromagnetic waves you send away from the box, they just leave that direction. Alpha waves cannot leave anyway.
After the first collision, how much destruction?
Ah, yes, that's a good question. Yes, it's yeah. So, okay, actually I had a separate plot, but I know this question would not be interesting, so I didn't include it. But you can still have. It's an important question that that tells you something about how quickly you could expect the thing to dissipate. Anyway, so this shows this plot shows the history of dissipation. This is the delta U is the dissipated fraction of energy that is stored in the packets, not including the background field. And so you notice the initial energy of the packet. So the vibration is just a fraction. And so you see here the history. You see a step-like curve. So each step is one collision, OK? And different colors correspond to different amplitudes of the turbulence. So this is the weakest one, and this is the strongest. Amplitude delta B over B is 3. So of course, not surprising, the stronger the packets, the bigger is the non-linearity in the system, also the effective dissipation. So these curves go above those curves. And then you can see nicely this step. This time scale is in units of collision, of light crossing time of the system.
So do you expect the same behavior in pure MHD, or is this a force-free?
I'll get to that question. Yeah, so I think in 3D it's more or less the same. But if you take the right limit, I'm still not certain. This is very high infinite sigma, effectively. Plasma. It's force-free, it's magnetically. And so force-free is a kind of MHD. But it's a special limit of MHD when the plasma inertia is nothing, it's not there. But force-free, of course, so it's partially addresses your question. So you can imagine different setups where you start to see big differences between MHD and even between MHD and force-free, and even bigger differences, also some differences between MHD and full kinetic peak simulations, which Chen Yu also has done, but it's not published yet.
Okay.
So in the setup that I just described, so you have two, you have torsion here, torsion there, and then and the packets collide. Force free works perfectly well. E is never larger than B. So it's like ideal MHD, a condition respected, and then you have nice turbulence. You just need to do it in 3D to get the results right. Now, you can imagine different setup, just different polarization of the wave. So, for example, you can consider linear polarization, often waves, with magnetic vectors pointing in the same direction. That's one extreme limit, just linear polarization, two packets colliding like this, or magnetic field pointing in the opposite directions. So, when you do the packets pointing in the opposite direction, then if you just naively do, it's not vacuum waves, of course, but if you naively do superposition, when they collide, the two vectors of B cancel each other, while the electric fields, because they move in the opposite direction, add. And so this is what drives you to the situation when E is larger than B. And that's what, we, of course, we see in the simulation. So what happens in force free? This is the curve. The dashed line shows the this anti-aligned packets colliding. So in this case, we see enormous dissipation because what force free does, it tries to all force-free simulations, they have to respect E smaller than B condition. And so what force-free codes do, they just chop off the extra electric field to keep it below B and effectively remove energy from the system. And this process is irreversible because for force-free, there's no component that could take the energy and momentum that you have removed in this way. So what happens with the energy as it evolves with time when the packets collide, this dashed curve, you lose energy, like you see, you lose 40% of energy in one collision. And then it's just you lost it forever. If you do exactly the same problem in MHD, relativistic MHD with high signal, let's say 10, then you get this blue curve. So you recover this energy. What happens is that when you collide these anti-aligned packets, you begin to accelerate plasma, just bulk acceleration in the perpendicular direction with huge E cross B drift speed. And the energy that you lose from the field goes into the bulk kinetic energy of the plasma. So it's like bow, if you like. You just pull it and then you release it. This plasma, eventually, you do recovery. So eventually, this bulk kinetic energy of the plasma goes back into the field. And the amount you have dissipated in MHD is actually small. So force free fails in this situation.
They don't stick together?
The packets? No, they don't stick.
But they start kind of reconnection layer and then.
Yes. So when you do this in peak, actually, which could be done also, it's more like reflection. The two symmetric packets, they collide, you excite strong motion in perpendicular direction, there is interesting kinetics there. There's no trivial distribution of particles. So we've been playing with that and trying to understand exactly how you form the distribution function that you see. It's not trivial. There is particles that were sitting initially close to each other go very far eventually, like you, the trajectories depart dramatically. So effectively you have kind of, even though it's collisionless and formally reversible system if you do kinetics, eventually, effectively you have dissipation in that system and strong heating.
Force free
really prevent
E from being greater than B, or is that just something you do for convenience?
So force free does not tolerate E greater than B, right? Force free doesn't tolerate E like E dot B is E is always smaller than B because otherwise you demagnetize particles. Force free
waves become imaginary.
You don't have reconnection because magnetic field of opposite polarity are too far. They're essentially a package distance.
Are too what?
Too far.
Too far from what?
From each other, opposite polarities. One is, you know, when you... okay, we can discuss this.
Andre, if I take just one package and propagate, how long will this take? Is it
nothing will happen.
Nothing
will happen. It will stay there. Keep bouncing.
Well, in force free, but in MHD,
you have to organize.
It's going to decay. I think, like David mentioned, the dark wave will slow, go parametric decay becomes a slow wave and not a half wave.
I don't think, well, I don't think anything should happen in this case. I mean, you have just...
For MHT, not phosphoric.
Even for MHT, in the limit, well, I don't know what you call MHT, in the limit of very high sigma, certainly it's just like phosphoria.
So
in reality, though, in reality...
Sigma is 10, what's your beta?
Beta? Well, the plasma is cold, but it's, it's not really important.
So even in MHD, you can organize a soliton, which would propagate forever, not dissipation, but you have to organize the field in a special way.
For this particular system, though, this question is kind of, I mean, there is another way of removing energy from the system. I will get there if we have enough time. But
that's accelerated.
Yeah, because I'm stuck now in turbulence, which is a subtopic of the first topic. Okay. So that was remark one, that you have to be careful with FFE simulation. You need to do MHD, ideally full peak. But it depends on your setup. There are setups when it's force free is perfectly good. Remark number two for this problem, how the energy dissipates. So there is an important physics point here, a simple one, that when you have the cascade, the main dissipation mechanism, unlike the kinetic simulations that many people do for turbulence, here the main way of dissipating energy is Compton drag, is drag of the bulk motions of the plasma in the turbulence against the radiation. Now it's a little tricky in the sense that it quickly becomes optically thick, so radiation is trapped with the plasma, so it cannot dissipate the plasma when it's trapped with it. But on small enough scale, like silk damping in the universe, on small enough scale, radiation begins to decouple and diffuse through the plasma. And effectively, the simplest way to think about it is that photons provide viscosity, right? So there is effective viscosity that you can calculate as proposed scales with radiation density. Okay, so this viscosity determines the viscous cutoff of the turbulence, which is way above the collisionless scales. And so when the condition for the turbulence cascade to be cut off by this drag rather than by any kinetic effects is written here. Well, actually for Kolmogorov spectrum in this three sensitive, but it's anyway. So V naught, this is optical depth across the largest eddies. V naught is the velocity of the largest eddies. So tau is basically isolated. And W is relativistic enthalpy of radiation. So 4/3 times radiation energy density divided by effective inertia of the plasma. So this thing is roughly unity, let's say. So the point is that this condition is safely satisfied in fireballs, in magnetars. And so this plot explains what happens in the two cases, when this condition is satisfied and when it is not satisfied. So when you have a cascade to smaller and smaller scales, this is the situation when it goes all the way without being affected very much by Compton, by this radiation drag. And it goes all the way to microscopic plasma scales. But if your optical depth is large enough, when you look at this plane which compares the timescale for turbulence eddies to produce smaller turbulence energy, the cascade timescale, you compare it with the Compton drag timescale, right? There is a region on this plane versus eddy size, right? There is a region where Compton damping dominates. So if you have your cascade propagating to smaller and smaller scales, and if you hit this region, you can never continue. Basically, you cut off.
How do you calculate collisionless damping?
So to calculate this, you don't...
Collisionless damping, you understand it's not Compton.
In this situation?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we don't calculate it because it does not apply to the situation that I'm talking about, right? It's Compton drag. What I'm saying is that in this case, it's Compton drag that terminates the turbulence cascade. And so the energy goes directly from bulk motions of the fluid to radiation by Compton upscattering of background photons. Okay, and last remark on turbulence. So I mentioned there is another way of losing energy in the cascade, which is specific to Newton stars, and which is surprising somewhat, but still, it works. So Newton stars are not perfect walls. Okay, in fact, the crust, even though it's solid, but there is also ocean on top of the crust, there is a finite transmission coefficient for an alpha wave into the crust of the Newton star. And you can calculate this transmission coefficient. It's rather straightforward calculation. It's shown here. It's just for alpha waves. It's like string problem when you perturb the string and the shear modulus and the effective inertia density of the string is position dependent as you enter the crust. And so you can solve this one-dimensional problem and find the transmission coefficient. It's a order of 10%. That means that every time packets bounce from one point to another and get reflected, 90% is reflected, 10% goes into the star. So you need 10 bouncing to remove energy from the packet. That's why, actually, this way of dissipating energy, of removing energy from the cascade, is probably more important than the local turbulence dissipation, because it takes so many bouncings to fully develop turbulence and dissipate it.
How hard is the surface here?
How hot? Yes, so we've done this detailed calculation. Let me explain how you heat it and quickly. And then, so first of all, you want to know what happens with the energy that penetrates. Most of it penetrates after 10 bouncings into the crust. There is a characteristic depth in the crust. First of all, this is the velocity of the alpha wave as it enters, right? This is the effective shear modulus, elastic, plus magnetic tension of the field lines themselves. This is the effective inertia, density of the matter in the crust plus effective inertia in the field itself. In the magnetosphere, this is negligible, this is negligible. This comes from the crust. But so you see the velocity of alpha wave is C, as you expect. As you enter the crust, first this term becomes important. This is still negligible. So you have more inertia. The alpha wave now has to move around more mass. Okay, so it slows down because of that. Velocity drops. Then if you go even deeper layers, eventually even shear modules, elastic modules of the crust can become important. So the bottom line here is that as the alpha waves enter the crust, they decelerate. The whatever packet you're sending there is compressed because of that. Its amplitude is decreasing, but the strain, the derivative of the displacement, as you can see, basically this angle is increasing. So as the packet enters this dense medium, the angle of displacement, the strain, exceeds 0.1, which is the maximum the crust can tolerate, and it induces plastic flows in this material. That's how you dissipate energy. Now, you can calculate where the energy is dissipated. Without going into details, there's simple physics argument where the energy is dissipated. Plastic flow heats locally the system. You compare the heat you release with the heat you need to melt the crust. And basically, your wave energy that penetrates, all this energy eventually is spent to melt to a certain depth. And so basically, the liquid ocean, the bottom of the liquid ocean goes to lower and lower depths until you have used all the energy you have provided from the wave.
What's the melting temperature?
Now, the melting temperature depends on density. It's roughly 10 to the 9th characteristic for bottom, for deep crust. You can see here depths in it's like 600 meters, 500 meters. Well, it's more like actually a few hundred meters in this. You don't go to...
So you have to worry about neutrino cooling?
Yes, so we've done the detailed calculation for that. You can calculate this because we know exactly the density profile of the crust. It's well known. You can calculate from first principles, well known for many years. So you know exactly how the wave dissipates. You know exactly where you dissipate heat. You also know what is the heat conduction coefficient. You have a good idea of neutrino emission rates. So you can solve this problem exactly. And what you find is that you quickly, impulsively, this is millisecond time scale, you quickly, boom, you melt crust, you create this liquid ocean. Most of the heat is dissipated at the bottom because when the wave goes through the liquid, there's no shear, there's no plastic flow, there's no dissipation. So the energy is basically dissipated here, and then the heat diffuses back. Only about 10% of that heat. Most of that heat actually diffuses, heat diffusion, flows to the core, which is greedy for heat, it's cold, because temperature gradient goes that way. And then it's radiated through neutrinos from there mostly. Not locally, but also partially locally, neutrino reactions. But mostly heat conduction takes it into the core, and then you lose it.
Do you apply that most of the energy of turbulence is dissipated this way?
So it depends on the amplitude, the initial amplitude of the turbulence. So if the amplitude is like one, most of the energy would go to the star.
What is the energy that is feeding the fireball in this case?
Yes. So I'll come to. So this branch of the story finishes here. Basically, you can calculate how much heat diffuses back. You can calculate the time scale. So it's week to month time scale creates an afterglow, which we actually observe. I didn't include the slide because I wasn't sure.
It should be pulsing.
Yes, because you create a hot spot on the star, but it's a little more complicated in magnetar because the magnetosphere is not completely transparent. The emission that you produce from the surface gets scattered in the magnetosphere. There's some plasma, resonance scattering. It's not the normal scattering, resonance scattering. But
so,
yes, it should
so
be.
So what direction actually goes up as opposed to down?
10%.
10%.
Roughly speaking. It depends on primes.
So if I saw 10 to 43 Hertz, is that 10 to 44 going up?
Yeah, well, it depends on how strong your flare was, how, yeah. Yeah?
I mean, you should be able to calorimetry from the afterglow, right?
Yeah.
And just check out.
Yeah, I have a plot, I didn't include it, but this data, which does show this afterglow. On time scale, it's rise about like on a month time scale, and then it's okay. And I think that's the thing after giant flare. So it's giant flare, millisecond time scale, deposit heat.
How much energy is radiated in the afterglow?
How much energy? It varies from object to object, and it should because the amount, the cross section of this Alton wave populated field line bundle. Can be different. I don't know. I mean, can be narrow, could be big, and it sets the energy. But it's reasonable time scale. It's what you would expect for, I don't know, take 10% of the star, you create giant flare, and I mean, you create a flare on this 10% of the magnetic flux, calculate how much energy, you get, and you get right normalization for the afterglow that you see. Okay. How am I doing on time, Anatoly?
Well, it's 11:50, so we have like most 20 minutes.
Ah, should I ever get to FRPs then? Okay, I'll skip most of introduction. Sorry, most of.
this is
a pre-introduction. So I'll skip reconnection.
Let's say you have half an hour.
Okay, no, I don't want to, you know, well, I'll try to keep under 20 minutes for 15. Because reconnection stuff, you know, so there's solar flares, you overtwist magnetic flux tubes, and the flare, they produce a coronal mass ejection.
That's easy.
Yeah, that's easy. There are simulations for how you can do this in magnetars using force-free approximation. I'll skip them. Al Parfrey did it. So Lorenzo talked briefly about radiative reconnection. So this is, again, this is, okay, I'll say one thing about reconnection, which is kind of important, I think. This reconnection is different from solar flare reconnection, jet AGN jet reconnection, etc. It's different because of the strong radiation, of the high radiation density in the system. So when you form the small-scale structure through tearing, producing X-points, outflows from X-points, these things move in radiation field. And therefore, they are dragged by radiation. It's again, the Compton drag. And the bottom line is surprisingly similar to the turbulence. Most of the energy that you release by reconnection, actually, eventually all of it, most of it, is released through this bulk Comptonization process. So you keep the plasma cold, there are not much no thermal particles, and basically what magnetic energy goes to is to slashing around with relativistic, mild relativistic speeds, these chunks of cold plasma through radiation. Okay, that's the basic picture. And this is how these magnetic stresses, they pull, they do this work against the viscous force.
And this doesn't create turbulence, does it?
Well, in the simulation, which you would argue may not be complete, but Lorenzo would argue it's better. I would love to hear you fighting about this. But yeah, all I can say is that we don't see it.
Let's pick code and...
Yeah, okay, so...
It remains optically thin now.
Yeah, so this simulation is done with simplifying assumption with a fixed radiation field. But in reality, in the magnetar, again, you have to think about, also in Jarabi jets, it works similar way, or even in accretion disks around black holes. You have to think about optical depth. So on some scales, big enough structures will trap radiation and not back with it. On small enough structures, they decouple and to do this friction, if you like, damping. And but on very small scales, the magnetic forces are strong enough to do the usual stuff, like there's no radiation. So this is different from turbulence in the sense that there is a lot of power released on tiny scales, collisionless plasma scales. For when you drive turbulence cascade, you may never get this power delivered to small scales, so you don't worry about it in the presence of strong radiation. In the case of reconnection, you do worry about it, because tearing starts in very small scales, and then you do go through radiation. Actually, you can even measure, well, I'll skip this, no pulling, strong pulling. This is the fraction of energy of reconnection power that is deposited into non-bulk motion, let's say. So for non-radiative case, it's most of it. So you have just a lot of heat in the reconnection region. Particles individually are heated. In the case of strong cooling, like I said, most of the only small 20% asymptotical, 20% of energy released by reconnection is given to individual particles as opposed to the bulk motion of the plasma. So most of the released energy goes into the sloshing bulk motion. This is the qualitative difference between radiative regime and non-radiative regime. Of course, magnetars are ultra-radiative. That's how we should call it, I think, because in this case, not only a small fraction goes to these non-thermal particles. These particles never survive. It's all completely thermalized quickly. The thermalization timescale is tiny. So you produce just black body radiation, and everything is trapped in optical thick pure fireball. OK, fast radio bursts. So somehow, for many years, and I've been working also on this topic for, like, I don't know, 10 years, almost maybe even more now. So, but I never thought about the simple fact that actually these giant flares should produce ultra-relativistic blast waves, just like solar flares do. You launch shocks into the solar wind from a magnetic flare. Exactly the same thing has to happen in this case. We see it in the simulation, of course, and also you expect. So when you twist the magnetic field lines in the magnetosphere, you over-twist them, you release a plasmoid, it's ultra-relativistic in this case, it expands freely, just like spheromax that we see in the solar wind. They just fly away and with expansion and acceleration. This plasma is initially loaded with electron-positron plasma. It's annihilated. They have no baryons because they don't have enough time to pick up baryons from the surface. So that means it's just pure electromagnetic energy, which is expanding with growing drift speed up to Lorentz effective Lorentz factors like 10 to the 5.
There are pairs.
There are pairs initially, but they annihilate. They adiabatically cool down and annihilate. So there is a limit. You do see some winds. So the we saw three giant flares, and you do see ion, slow ion ejector that have to come after this initial. It's like more massive ejection. You need still to keep field lines open to let the baryon flow. But the initial trigger of reconnection, the leading part should be ultra-relativistic plasmoid. And then after that, it should be slow ions, which you actually observe. There's a lot of energy also, 10 to the 44 errors in the slow ion tail of that flare.
From recombination of pairs?
From recombination, you don't have to do good approximation. You have no ions there in this initial clean fireball. A lot of pairs, hot plasma, there are a lot of pairs because the temperature is 1 degree. Mm-hmm. Once it drops below 20 keV, even you exponentially suppress the pair population, and there is some pair freeze out.
Should we see the 512 keV line?
Oh, no, it's difficult. Observations are difficult there. It's, if you calculate how much pair, in principle, yes, yeah. But you don't, what you see in giant flares, First of all, that's going to be collimated most likely away from you. You don't even see this relativistic plasmoid. It probably goes in one direction, so you need to be lucky so it goes into your direction. This annihilation line will be blue shifted by some Lorentz factor. You don't have good instruments for that, and yeah.
You say the Lorentz factor is like 10 to the 5?
Yep, it grows.
So, for which line?
Time is the gamma factor. Oh, it's gamma 5, 10 to the 5, it's already completely frozen. I mean, there's no annihilation, but initially it's a lower gamma at the time of freeze out. But it's hard to observe anyway. I checked it. So this is the picture of this blast wave. Well, this is a nice picture of solar wind blast wave. So here, the main thing I think you want to know about this is that if you take the flare power, the duration is like a fraction of millisecond. That's how long it takes to release this fireball. The total energy, we don't know. It could be 10 to the 45, 10 to the 46, or it can vary. The ratio of the two is the characteristic power that you deposit into, that drives the explosion. So that characteristic number would be 10 to the 47. Maybe it could be bigger, it could be smaller. But anyway, that is in the 1/4 power. Now, another factor here is the pre-flare wind. So the magnetar continually produces spin-down wind, like any normal pulsar. And so, again, the exact wind luminosity is known only within a couple of 1 or 2 orders of magnitude, but it's not tremendously important. So normalized to 10 to the 39. And so the ratio of the pre-flare wind Lorentz factor, which I'll explain in the next slide, is about 10 for magnetars, very different from canonical pulsars. And this gamma is the Lorentz factor of the blast itself. So their ratio can be calculated from simple pressure balance. So you have a piston, you have external medium, which runs away from you with some gamma W. And the ground pressure balance tells you what is the Lorentz factor of the medium behind the blast wave. This is this capital gamma. So the ratio of the two is 100. So if this is 10 or 20, the Lorentz factor of the blast wave itself is 1,000 or a few thousand. Okay? One slide for the wind. So this is before the flare. If you want to understand what blast wave can do and what observational signal will climb, this is how you can produce FRBs. To understand what the blast waves emit and what the dynamics of blast wave is, you need to know the wind properties. And so, like I said, the wind from spin-down wind from magnetars is much slower from pulsar than the wind from pulsars, I think, for the following reason. There is much more pairs created and loaded into the wind. And the reason why you create many more pairs, because of this mass loading, you make it relatively slow. Remember, I'm talking about now the persistent wind, not the explosion, but this is before the explosion. The star is rotating, and it's like normal spin-down wind. And the question is how much power it flows away from the star, let's say 10 to 39, 38 Earth per second, versus how much particles you load into the wind. Energy per particle determines eventually the Lorentz factor of the wind. The classical Michael result is that the asymptotic Lorentz factor of the wind, if you stay away from the equatorial region, it's going to be called helical wind. It's given just by this formula. So eta is the energy per particle in the wind. John Kirk explained that how interesting thing can happen near the equatorial plane, but you have the striped wind, but I'm staying away from striped because I think it's not good environment for producing FRB. Near the poles, you have cold helical wind with this Lorentz factor. Now, this parameter eta is determined by the power of the wind and the number of particles you create. Now, what process creates the particles? These are, again, photons that are emitted by the magnetosphere and converted into pairs. And the principal difference between magnetars and normal pulses is that currents, electric currents, flowing in the magnetosphere are a million times stronger than it would be for a normal pulsar. In a normal pulsar, the reason why we have electric currents is that you have some open field lines that go beyond the light cylinder, they receive twist, and you have to maintain a so-called Goldreich Julian current. It's limited to the open field line bundle. In this case, these are relatively slow rotators, so the light cylinder is 10 to the 4 times the radius of the star. The open current is not strong. But the magnetosphere itself, the closed field lines, is strongly twisted. And therefore, there are much stronger currents flowing through the magnetosphere itself, a million times stronger. And all these currents are supported by pair creation. So I'll omit the detailed calculation, but I've done this detailed calculation with simulation of how we create pairs. And the bottom line is that you pollute the entire magnetosphere with heavy pair creation within a radius of about 10 stellar radii. And you can estimate how many pairs should be loaded. And that's how you come up with this estimate for eta. Okay? In the end, it enters to the 1/3 power. So the exact, I mean, there's a big uncertainty here, but it gives you a good estimate for the Wien-Lorentz factor. It's a few tenths maximum, unlike normal pulses, where hundreds to thousands. Okay, and of course, magnetization is determined just by its related. So the reason why gamma is smaller than eta is that the energy that didn't go to kinetic energy stays in the pointing flux. The product of magnetization prime times gamma wind is fixed by the total energy per particle here. Okay, so characteristic values for this problem is that this is like 10, and this is like 30, and this is like 30, let's say. Oh, this is 10, and this is 10. Magnetization is 10. This is the dynamics of the blast wave. It's easy to solve. There is acceleration stage up to the fast magnetosonic radius where you stop pushing the wind. It's kind of causally disconnected. This is where the wind speed becomes equal to the fast magnetosonic wave speed in the pressure of the plasma. So this is ahead of, now so I'm in this wind, which I just described, I now do explosion, okay? So I basically send the piston, impulsive, nearly impulsive push. It drives a blast wave in this wind. The Lorentz factor of the blast wave is 100 times bigger than the wind Lorentz factor. Now, one more thing to note here is that the forward shock that runs, this forward shock of the blast wave is moving faster than the blast wave material itself by the square root of sigma factor. This comes from jump conditions. Strongly magnetized shocks are slightly special because they fast magnetosonic wave propagates with Lorentz factors square root of sigma. So the shock has to run away from the post-shock material with nearly speed of light, with Lorentz factor equal to square root of sigma. So the shock itself moves faster than the blast. This is an interesting point. And the blast wave begins to eventually to decelerate when it sweeps up enough material, basically when all the energy in this 1 millisecond wide piston eventually is transferred to the blast wave. It begins to decelerate because after that point it begins to sweep up more and more matter, and then its Lorentz factor begins to drop. All right, now FRBs. I need maybe 3 more minutes, and that should be done. So that's the picture of the shock. The wind carries field, of course, which is transverse to the shock direction, to the radial direction, because it's a wind. Only toroidal component survives. Radial component goes as a 1 over r squared from flux freezing. Toroidal component goes as 1 over r, so far from the source of the wind, it's transverse field. So you send the shock wave into transverse field, which is magnetically dominated. Sigma is like 10. These shocks don't accelerate particles at all, as we know. They just heat the plasma. They basically dissipate relative kinetic energy between upstream and downstream and put it into Maxwellian plasma. They try to radiate it, but they fail. They're not really cool. So it produces some synchron emission, but it's hard to observe from these explosions if they are far. But the interesting side here is the shock itself, which has thickness of order of gyro radius. And what happens in the shock is that you have this maser emission that Alan worked on, and then several papers back in the 1992, Basically, the shock thickness is one Larmor rotation. You have the soliton type structure, and the soliton is this ring-like structure is unstable. You can think of it as a maser. You create bunching, and you start to radiate a wave, electromagnetic wave, with the period equal to the Larmor period, or the frequency equal to the Larmor frequency. The Larmor radius is set by the just the energy the particle has got, which is relative. This divided by gamma wind, basically, that's the relative Lorentz factor between upstream and downstream, and the gyrate and the compressed magnetic field behind the shock. And so the radial burst, I'm just list the six properties that you expect from this explosion, and we'll be done. So first of all, you can calculate the frequency of these. I don't have time to describe the details. The solution itself for the shock, of course, is interesting, somewhat controversial. But anyway, so the characteristic frequency is there. It's robust. So it's this Larmor frequency, basically, which you can calculate for the blast wave that I just described. And the parameters of the piston and the pre-flare wind entered in 1/4 power. They're not really changing too much. But what you find is that this blast wave produces semi-coherent gigahertz waves at the radius around 10 to the 14, which is comparable to the deceleration radius of the blast wave. Okay? So that's one that you find, just directly from this simple formula. Two, as known from peak simulation, as that you might expect, only waves that move faster than the shock itself will escape. Waves behind the shock get absorbed in the downstream. And this is how you thermalize and produce the Maxwellian plasma behind the shock. Those waves that have sufficient beaming so that it can overtake the shock, they escape. That sets the beaming angle of this emission, okay? It's just one over gamma shock. And the gamma shock, like I told you, is the blast wave Lorentz factor times the square root of magnetization. You can calculate the Doppler factor of this which is of this it corresponds to this beaming, and it's basically 2 gamma, and it sets the compression of the time scale of the burst that you produce. Okay, so you have a source of waves that moves with very high Lorentz factor toward you at a radius of 10 to the 14 centimeters. Naively, you would say, okay, what's the duration? It will be a radius over C, which would be like thousands of seconds. But because you have this Doppler effect, this beaming, you have the compression factor of 1 over gamma squared, and the duration happens to be less than 1 millisecond, comparable to 1 millisecond. So these shocks have to emit, if the physics is right, they have to emit a radial burst which lasts less than 1 millisecond. Okay? Now, deficiency. Efficiency is about 10 to the minus 5.
How many turns does it make?
So that depends on sigma. So for if you. So for
would
sigma.
Would that explain the substructure in the first?
No, I don't think so. It's all compressed. I mean, as far as it's all new, kind of, but as far as I understand, if I believe the model, I cannot play too much with the values of this compression factor, for example. I think it's hard to resolve the substructure. I mean, they do see. What you predict here is the drift of frequency with time. Actually, they do see it. I don't think this substructure can come from the shock itself. To get the right time scales, the substructure can come from the wind variability before the explosion.
The millisecond duration comes. Within 1 millisecond, it does several turns. So why can't you see?
I don't know. It does many, many, many turns when you double the radius. So the millisecond duration is the time it takes to double the radius, but you divide this time by gamma squared and compress it. That's why it becomes millisecond. But of course, in other words, the millisecond is the duration of the burst, but you can calculate how many periods the wave did, and it will be like 10 to the 4 or something. So you don't resolve these individual durations. Yeah. But when the magnetosphere is pregnant with the flare, it's inflated, and eventually it's you know, it's it, the wind it produces, it should be different from the standard, can be significantly different from the wind well before the flare. And so the variability of this wind, it can be unstable, could be imprinted in the eventual variability that comes from the shock as it crosses this wind. So this, I think, how you can produce this temporal structure. But there is an additional, completely different mechanism of imprinting structure on FRB, just propagation effects. If you send delta function through plasma in the host galaxy, it could be lensing, and then it affects the rays. This is efficiency. It's like 10 to the minus 5 for these parameters, and it's measured in the simulations. This is energy of the blood of the fast radio burst that you see normalized to the energy of the blast wave that you drive, basic energy of the explosion. So 10 to the minus 5 is the characteristic number, the fraction of the total explosion energy that goes into radio waves. And it's small. But because radio instruments are so sensitive, you get an interesting energy budget. And each, even if you have 10 to the, this is like total energy budget in the magnetar, maybe 10 to the 49 ERGs. 10 to the minus 5 of it goes into the fast radio burst. So you can emit over lifetime of a magnetar. And by talking about, I didn't talk about this, but it's most likely the FRBs we see come from hyperactive magnetars, which are younger than all the magnetars we see in our galaxies, when they're hyperactive, when their dynamics is dominated by ambipolar diffusion in the core. And so here, basically, the main point is that if you emit 10 to the 39 erg by 10 to the 5 bursts, that would fit perfectly well the most famous FRB repeater that we know now, 121102. And of course, you can distribute this energy into less frequent flares, but stronger flares. And energetically, it works just fine. So the energy budget in the fast radio burst that we see is just right for magnetars. So to conclude, I'll skip induced scattering. It's another interesting topic, but we don't have time for that. This is the concluding summary of FRBs. These are their observed properties. So why I think they likely produced by this mechanism? Because first of all, it was noted by Popov and Pasnov immediately, almost after the discovery of FRBs. The rate of FRBs in the universe is comparable to the rate of giant flares of magnetars, roughly, order of magnitude. Both rates are not known exactly, but they have comparable magnitude.
Is that confirmed?
I believe it because I don't believe either of the rates that have been reported. So within the uncertainty, they match. But we're talking about factor of 10.
Unlike from three flares?
Yeah, from three flares and also what you might expect from magnetars. But when you should keep in mind that when you discuss other scenarios, there are more than I didn't discuss here. In particular, cataclysmic type scenarios, like associating with neutron star mergers of GRBs, they are all by thousands. Because these are rare events. Here, we don't know. We may be off by a factor of 10, but it's consistent within the air. It's not easy to find such a frequent source in the universe. Giant flares is unusually, it is a very frequent source of flares, unlike supernova explosions, you know, not to mention GRBs. If you think of it, what flares so frequently? That would be this object. Magnetars. We see them all the time. Not maybe giant flares.
We've never seen it repeating.
Magnetars repeat all the time. They produce bursts.
Giant
flares, no.
We don't know.
So there are three giant flares. They all came from different magnetars. But we see normal bursts, and it's like a continuum. So you see weaker bursts, and you see giant flares. The difference between normal bursts and giant flares is how much optical depth you have. How, of course, total energy scale, how, and whether you are able to open the the magnetosphere. But there is no reason not to expect them to repeat, because if you believe in the basic underlying mechanisms, how you twist the fields and do magnetic flares, just like in the sun, it should repeat. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that would be a prediction. They should repeat, but it could destroy
the crust.
Well, the crust is very hard to destroy, because if imagine if you are Newton's star and suddenly you are deprived of your crust, what do you do? You reform it immediately, because there is a right with enormous gravity, compress the material, and you reform it. You can estimate the time scale, but I don't know those time scales, I'm sure. I mean, you cannot have a bare sea of neutrons, of course, yeah. Durations are, observed durations are 1 millisecond. They see frequency drifts from high to low on these time scales. Energies of the burst vary in this region, in this window, roughly, sometimes a little stronger, really, sometimes a little weaker. But it's just what you expect from blast wave from magnetars with this 10 to the minus 5 efficiency. They are linearly polarized. There is one case, this is the famous burst, it's nearly 100% polarization. And for blast waves, for magnetars, it should be linearly polarized. And the polarization angle should be basically set by the magnetar rotation axis projected on the sky. Because the wind is toroidal, there is toroidal field. And this is toroidal with respect to rotation axis of the magnetar. And the mode that escapes is set by the direction of the magnetic field. And so what we see in this object is it's linear polarization with constant position angle throughout the burst. And then there is persistent counterpart, which is consistent with magnetar ejecting this object, which has the right energy around the amount of particles. And I'll stop. I should have stopped. So this is my conclusions. I'll stop here.
Thank you. How can we disprove this problem?
How we can disprove it?
So you mentioned magnetar flares, and the comparison with the solar case is that there's a distribution of flare strength, from the very strongest to the very weakest. But so is there a distribution in FRB? So, is there something special about why do you are there
some FRBs
that haven't been detected yet?
Good questions. I'm probably all
looking
the same.
So that would be a kind of proof-disproof.
Yeah. So FRBs have very different strengths. And I'm looking forward to new or not, because now it's just happening right now. Like a year ago, we had only like 30 FRBs. Now we'll have thousands. Because of time, and there will be more, much more. So the field is exploding, data-wise. But so I think there was already a paper reporting the distribution. It's a broad distribution with some parallel, and the paper claimed it's consistent with the magnetar flare distribution, which is similar to the solar flare distribution. Five-thirds, it's kind of, you can think of self-organized criticality. Yeah, so it looks like FRBs follow similar distribution, magnetars do. Another feature is that the repeaters, so of course I talk about frequent repeaters. You need many repeaters to see, to analyze the statistics, because otherwise you don't also, you need to know the distance, because for most you don't know the distance, you don't know the intrinsic luminosity. And anyway, so you expect occasional rare flares, and you expect, by the way, now another thing that I didn't mention, you could have an optical flash. But for that, I would need to explain a little longer. You need to, the default prediction is you don't see any counterpart. If you see a gamma ray counterpart, or X-ray counterpart, which is above certain value, you would disprove it. Because the blast wave, I think, is not capable of producing detectable X-ray emission or gamma ray emission.
Yes, but couldn't you have something else that the X-ray is emitting?
The flare itself produces hard X-rays and gamma rays, of course, lasting much longer and completely overshining the blast wave. But if you talk about soft X-rays and optical, then if you just calculate the Rayleigh-Jeans constraint, the maximum luminosity you can get from the flare region itself, the compact region, that would start to be below the blast wave. But this is too weak luminosity to detect.
Well, I just want to say that you can get coherent non-thermal optical imaging. And as far as X-rays and gamma rays, I don't think that these things coincide with gamma ray bursts in any way. But occasionally one might. Mm-hmm. And I can imagine if two neutron stars merge, the first thing that happens is that magnetospheres touch, and they make an F5B, and then they make a gamma ray burst.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it could be. Also, the magnetosphere itself, there are, I didn't mention, but there are alternative models. How the magnetosphere itself could produce coherent radio burst and optical. I know also you had a paper with, I think, with Lubarsky some time ago, I think, on coherent infrared optical emission.
Yeah.
From, yeah. So the magnetosphere, it's, I think, my understanding, I cannot prove it at this moment, but I think it's very hard for coherent wave with the strength parameter A, which is, well, here it's comparable to unity from the blast wave, 0.1, which is marginally strong. But if the signal comes from the neutron star magnetosphere itself, the strength parameter would be enormous, like 10 to the 10th or something.
And
the strength parameter of the electromagnetic wave that comes from the magnetosphere, it would be enormous. And I don't think it will escape. Even though you do have magnetic field lines, you know, plasma strongly magnetized and particles are constrained to move along the field lines. But anyway, there are models that suggest, well, by hand actually, that if you do sufficient bunching that you may might work like antenna at the right frequency and produce coherent emission. I don't quite believe this scenario, but there are several works by Katz, Kumar and Liu. Maybe I'm forgetting someone. I think Maxim Ludig talked about it at some point.
Then to the 5 more energy went into the wind. Should we see some holes in the ISM blown by these magnetars in our galaxy?
10 to the 30, right, so 10 to the 39 erg per second from the pre-flare wind of a hyperactive magnetar, which is the characteristic age of these FRB sources, at least the one we know, is like probably a few tens of years. So these are hyperactive young objects which do giant flares much more frequently than this old population that
right.
we see. Yeah.
But we had these
in the past.
In the galaxy, somewhere.
Yeah. So in the this on this time scale, when you're still sitting in the supernova remnant, you have a lot of energy extracted from the magnetar, not only magnetic energy, also rotational energy, because it may be still spinning initially when it was born with significant spin. And the question is, where did this energy go? So there is a long-standing problem for the magnetar population, is why the supernova remnants that have been identified are not much different from normal supernova remnants. Why they didn't get much more energy? Even though we know that in the center is a magnetar. It's especially a problem for theories that that explain the birth of a magnetar by ultra-fast rotation millisecond period, because this 10 to the 52 ergs that is sitting in the rotating neutron star has to go somewhere. And I think what could explain it, even though I never published this explanation, but somehow, anyway, so I think what could be happening is that when you spin down a millisecond neutron star, you actually apply torque from the light cylinder to the polar cap, not to the entire star. And when you apply torque to the polar cap, you basically stop the column on, near the axis of rotation, while the rest of the star around it keeps rotating. So you create differential rotation. And effectively, you create a resistor, if you like, a dissipation site, inside the star. So you deposit energy, rotation energy, not into the wind that goes away from the system, but you deposit it into heating the star itself by creating, by stopping the central column, later in creating this differential rotation, which may be stored by magnetic field lines. That's the open question.
That doesn't dissipate angular momentum.
It doesn't dissipate, well, angular momentum doesn't carry energy. So flux of angular momentum is not directly, you need lever to.
Right, but then, yeah. Then it's an internal engine, right? You can heat without that.
Yes, and then where does the energy go? It goes to neutrinos. And good luck finding the neutrino energy. So that's why the supernova remnants just. No, that's it. I mean, that's my idea that I have. But indeed, it has been around for. It's true for normal magnetars. We see 30 of them, like 10 supernova remnants. Why these remnants are the same? We know these are magnetars now.
I have a question about your point number one. It puzzled me for many years. So your initial deformation is 100 milliseconds.
This you don't know. I like much
longer. Even longer. Actually.
Even longer. Yeah. I think most likely.
Whereas
it's much longer.
The light travel time between the arcades is milliseconds. So if you do a force-free sequence of equilibrium simulation, the arcades expands first.
Yep.
They don't want to be twisted. So they expand and open.
Yeah.
Which then. Goes back to the initial setup where you're trying to bounce the arcing waves and cause it to cascade and dissipate. Mm-hmm. So the question puzzled me for many years would be, would the magnetosphere expand and not trapping as effective, so you can't heat the plasma or dissipate the plasma, the field energy as?
Yeah, that's the simulation that was done by Kalper for, about how this expansion, you see the inflation, as you twist up the field, color is the twist, is B-phi component. You start with dipole, you twist it up, you start to inflate the field lines. You see this, you just marked one field line with red color. It was here initially and it began to inflate and open. And then eventually you see the tearing here and reconnection. So.
This happens over a time scale shorter than the deformation.
This is very gradual process. So you can inflate, even in the simulation, you do this very gradually on a time scale much longer than the elephant crossing time scale. So you gradually pump the twist, slowly come to the marginal stability when the twist angle is like 3, and that it goes unstable. And the way it goes unstable is that you inflate it, the field lines inflate, then they flatten here, they form a current sheet, you have tearing, and you form plasmoids, and you do the eject.
Which is quite different from the arcing wave bouncing.
Ah, there was just color, we missed. There were Alfen wave bouncing. So we'll see it again, because we keep doing this here.
But most energies
keep twisting. So you pump, and then with instability, boom, you see Alfen waves bouncing. Yeah, but I think the primary source of energy is reconnection. It's not the turbulence. Okay.
Thank you.